me today, we have Bart Armentrout, who's going to teach you all about dynamical systems theory and oscillations and neural networks. And he's really a world's expert in this field. He's worked on a variety of interesting subjects, ranging from hallucinations to oscillations and synchrony. And I think actually, if you study many different theories of computational neuroscience, it's extraordinarily prolific. So, and he also, perhaps you could try to pin him down. He's also a great composer of limericks about famous neuroscientists. So, he might try to wake you up later on with one of those.
Well, I think actually the way to wake you up is probably voodoo glow skulls or rancid or something like that. Okay, I'm going to use the blackboard for the most part because I was convinced on Saturday night, and it was easy to convince me to do this, to use the blackboard because it was supposedly easier to convey information than with PowerPoint slides. And anyway, I don't use PowerPoint. I use no Microsoft products. So if somebody can turn that off and lift the screen up, I will sort of give you an outline of what I want to talk about. Well, I guess you could do that. That's the way to do it. Okay. All right. New chalk. And is there a way to light the blackboard? When you get my age, your vision fails. All right. Whoa, cool. All right. So I'm here, I guess, to talk about dynamics and oscillations and other things like that. And basically, I don't know what you guys know and what you don't know and what you want to know. I have lots of notes here that I can talk about pretty much anything along the lines of neural dynamics of neural networks all the way down to dynamics of membrane models and oscillations and things like that. So I will kind of tell you, I'm going to mostly talk about oscillations, with apologies to Larry Abbott, who I'm told hates oscillations and in particular hates synchrony. Well, I guess in answer, I hate information theory. And I guess you guys know some. Do you guys know a lot of neuroscience, or you don't know much neuroscience and you know a lot of dynamical systems, or you know neither, or what? I'm not sure where I lie. Let me first talk about where oscillations arise and where some of the examples I'm going to talk about come from. CPGs, or central pattern generators, are responsible for motor control, repetitive motor control. If you've ever watched animals walk or animals swim, or if you've ever had a bird, I have a number of birds, and when the birds get excited, they bob, and that's probably some sort of central pattern generator or repetitive motor activity that's controlled by networks of neurons. Some classic examples that a lot of you are probably familiar with here are somatogastric ganglion, and that's in the lobster and the crab and stuff, and that's responsible for chewing and crushing up food. There's lots of respiratory oscillators that control your breathing and things like that. There's lots of work done on the brainstem on those. Locomotion, of course, and I'll point out gates. Not Bill Gates, who is the enemy, but animal gates, which are, you know, four-legged and two-legged pronks and trots and gallops and things like that. And swimming, anguilliforce swimming, like eels swim and like lampreys swim and things like that. And I'm going to talk about some of these. Probably I'll talk about swimming. I'm not going to talk too much about these things because I don't know much about them. And then for these are all so-called central pattern generators. That's what that stands for. Central. Am I writing big enough? I know, I'm not going to ask if I'm writing neat enough, because that's something I cannot control. I can control the size of the font, but not the quality. But not the quality. Now, the other kinds of oscillations, and these are far more controversial, are cortical oscillations and higher and cortical and in higher order nervous system oscillations. And I'll give you some examples there. The olfactory bulb, which is also related to the procerebral lobe in the Lemax, and the antennal lobe. All these are sort of analogous structures in brains at various levels of animals. Olfactory bulb you find in mammals and reptiles. Procerebral lobe you find in mollusks, and the antennal lobe you find in insects. But they're all similar in their structure and similar in the fact that they oscillate in rather complicated patterns when presented with stimuli. The turtle cortex, turtle visual cortex, David Kleinfeld works on that, and so does Larry Cohen. There also are oscillations, and I'll talk a little bit about those. There's lots of oscillation work in hippocampal slice preparations. Those of you, I guess everybody's had, you guys have had some sort of tutorial on brain anatomy and stuff, right? So you know the hippocampus is a seahorse-shaped structure that if you take the lid off the head and then you rip off the cool part that you always see in bad brain movies, that's the cortex, then you get underneath of it and you get the thalamus and you get the hippocampus and all that cool stuff, like, you know, if you stick the electrodes into like the amygdala and stuff, you can inject it and you make, you know, your little rat into this killer thing that'll rip a cat's heart out and stuff, you know. So there's all those cool parts that are underneath the cortex that don't make you think, you just do. All the sex stuff is there too. Cortical oscillations, these have been popular for some time, 40 hertz oscillations. As to whether they have any function, that's still controversial. But I'm still, that's not going to stop me from talking about it. I'm a mathematician. I like oscillations and waves and things like that. So the function's clear over here, and over here it's less clear. Although there's been some really nice recent work by Gilles Laurent and other people that show that oscillations are rather necessary in these olfactory structures in order to discriminate fine differences in odors. So the other place that you see oscillations are in pathologies. So examples are like epilepsy and tremor of various types, Parkinson's disease, a disease that's been in the news a whole lot lately, Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, has a very, very stereotypical oscillatory EEG. And that's believed to be because it causes a breakdown of the cellular structures and increases the coupling between them. So it's like boosting the coupling and gap junctions. That's another example of oscillations that occur in pathologies. And of course, tremor and epilepsy, you've all seen that. So what I want to do today is I'm going to try and use neural oscillations as a way to introduce you to some dynamical systems concepts. I don't know how much, everybody here I assume knows about differential equations. Is that correct? Am I correct in making that assumption? And fixed points and stability and that sort of stuff. You may not know so much about homoclinics or things like that. So I'll talk a little bit about the more advanced topics like that. Most of the mathematics I'm going to talk about involves a method called the method of averaging. And I'll discuss that and how you can use that to do all kinds of things like derive neural networks from biophysical models, how to understand large arrays of coupled oscillators, and things like that. So there's different ways that neural oscillations can arise. And feel free to stop me at any time, okay? And I'm going to talk about different kinds of neural oscillations. There's network-induced ones that use firing rate models. And I see from Larry Abbott's notes that he did his chapter 7 from his book on firing rates. So you guys are all experts on firing rate models and phase planes and Wilson-Cowan equations or not? No? Okay, well, we'll talk a little bit about that. Firing rate models. And then you can have intrinsic oscillations in spiking neurons. With ion channels and things like that. And I guess you guys have had the Hodgkin-Huxley type stuff already, right? Okay, good, good. And finally, bursters. Bursters are bursting neurons, and bursting networks are situations where the neuron sits around and does nothing for a while and then fires a whole bunch of action potentials, and it does this regularly. Okay, and bursters show up in all kinds of things. And I'll talk about those at some length as well. Whoa, cool. So it's like putting, do you ever do that when you were kids? We used to put chalk in the eraser? Yeah. The other thing we used to put in the eraser was nitrogen triiodide. That's really cool stuff because when you touch it, it blows up. See. Actually, we didn't put it in erasers. You put it on the floor by the chalkboard, so when you step on it, it blows up. It's not as gross as the dog poop in the bag lit on fire on the table, but I don't know if kids do that anymore. I don't think so. You know, these days you get arrested for doing anything, right? I mean, I really feel bad for kids today. You can't really do anything fun. Everything's dangerous, huh? Okay, here you go, warnings on ladders, you know, do not use this to change your light bulb, really stupid things like, well, we got some firecrackers, we got these little tanks, you light them and you shoot, it says, do not hold in hand, do not set off inside. Oh, hello? anyway, so I want to start out a little bit, I'm going to describe basically some ideas for bifurcation theory and the onset of neural oscillations, all right, in spiking models. So to do that, I'm going to start out with the biophysical types of models, all right, and you guys are all familiar with these. So there's your standard Hodgkin-Huxley equation, and all these gating variables satisfy certain classes of certain simple differential equations. M dot equals M infinity of V minus M over tau sub M of V, and so on and so forth. And of course you have to include the injected current here. So that's your standard Hodgkin-Huxley model. This is a fast sodium. That's a so-called delayed rectifier. That's called a leak. So this is your Hodgkin-Huxley model. This is also the same model that's used for generating spiking. Different parameters and so on in hippocampal neurons and in cortical neurons and in fast spike units, so-called inhibitory inner neurons. This is basically the starting point of almost everybody's model for individual neurons. Okay. Now the key thing is these parameters are all different from model to model, and they have to be fit using something called voltage clamp. All right, and I guess somebody probably Kleinfeld must have explained voltage clamp to you, because I thought he talked a little bit about the derivation of the Hodgkin-Huxley equations, although I was told that, like everything else David does, it was idiosyncratic, I should say, shall I say. Okay, so this is the Hodgkin-Huxley type. I'm going to refer to several other models, too, and I'll write them down. Okay, this is a classic two-dimensional model. Called the Morris-Lacar equation. Okay, so I'll abbreviate that ML. Kathleen Morris and Harold Lacar. It was a model for barnacle muscle oscillations. Okay, and John Rinzel and I used this model extensively in a tutorial and also in a chapter that's in a book by Koch and Segev called Methods of Neuronal Modeling. And there's a really lovely long review of dynamics. It's probably one of the simplest expositions of spiking models and onset of spiking in neural models that's out there. I don't think there's anything else that is that covers the different models quite as easily. With a particular, just use one model and you just change parameters, you can get pretty much everything. So that's the Morris-Lacar equations. And then I also will talk about another model, which is a simplified version of models that occur in the thalamus. Okay, the thalamus is the structure that's underneath the cortex, and it's sort of the gateway for sensory stuff. It's responsible for sleep. Sleep oscillations and things like that. And the thalamus has neurons in it which have a really cool current called the calcium. It's a T-type calcium current. And the way that works is you sort of have to inhibit the neuron first. And then when you release it from the inhibition, you get this big calcium spike that sits in, you get this big burst of activity. Okay? And that's called the calcium type T current. And the simplest model, which you can write down, which has that in it, it's just got two variables in it. I mean, just, I minus GL, V minus EL, minus GCA, M infinity cubed of V, H times V minus ECA, and DH DT equals H infinity of V minus H over. All right, so this is, we'll call this the T current model, okay? It's a very simplified model for a thalamic neuron or reticular nucleus neuron, depending on what the parameters are. Okay, these two problems right here are planar dynamical systems. They're planar. There's only two variables. And so you can do the complete analysis of using the phase plane, using nulk lines and fixed points and direction fields. The Hodgkin-Huxley equations are a four-dimensional system, and therefore it's much harder to do things with it. Let me point out, two-dimensional systems have a lovely property. Because they're in the plane, there's this great theorem that when you're not a mathematician, you have no appreciation of this theorem. It's called the Jordan curve theorem. And it says that every curve, closed curve, separates things into the outside and the inside, which to your man on the street is, hello, so what? Yeah. That's why I build fences, right? So the point is that because of that, you can prove all kinds of nice existence theorems about oscillations, and you can show that oscillations exist in planar systems very easily. Beyond two dimensions, there's not many ways in which you can prove the existence of oscillations, except locally. But let me point out that in the Hodgkin-Huxley type thing, this variable M is very fast. okay? M is very fast. And it turns out that if you plot the trajectories, the solutions to this, if you plot H versus N in a parametric curve during a spike, okay, during an action potential or during repetitive firing. This is for the Hodgkin-Huxley. If you plot that, you get something that looks like this, okay? It almost lies on a straight line. And furthermore, as I said, M is very fast. So M is almost exactly equal to M infinity. So you can take this four-dimensional model and you can make the following approximation. M equals M infinity of V. That's approximation one. Now it's reduced to a three-dimensional equation because we've eliminated one variable. And number two, this is a really great little approximation. H equals 1 minus N. And if you do that approximation, it's almost quantitatively correct. It's qualitatively very nice, but it's almost quantitatively correct. And it's a two-dimensional problem now. And so you can analyze this thing in the phase plane as well. So one of the goals for people that are too stupid to prove theorems in complicated systems is to reduce it to two dimensions or to reduce it to something which you can prove theorems about. And that's sort of been one of the themes of what I do for a living. I'm interested in reducing things down into something that I can understand. Okay, my understanding of mathematics is very limited because my PhD is in biophysics, it's not in math. So I always try and collapse everything down and make it as simple as possible. One way you can do that is to make up ad hoc models like the integrate and fire. You guys have heard the integrate and fire, seen the integrate and fire model. And that's fine, but I can't really associate that with the original dynamical system that I'm interested in. Another way is to use various and sundry mathematical tricks to reduce things down into something where then you can see exactly where every parameter in your reduced system is related to the original parameters in your full system. Okay, so that's sort of one of my themes that I want to emphasize today. All right, so these are the three kinds of models I'll mostly talk about when I talk about biophysics. Later on, I'm going to add some bells and whistles to these when I talk about bursting. Okay, so let's talk about mechanisms of. Let me just draw the phase planes of these two guys because they're slightly different. Okay, let me just sketch the phase plane here. During an oscillation. So along this axis we have W and along this axis we have V. And during an oscillation for this particular model, for Morris-Lecar, you have a picture that looks like this. Okay, that's sort of a very typical phase plane. You'll see one fixed point, it's unstable. Okay, it's an unstable fixed point and the nice thing about all these biophysical models is everything has to lie in a box, okay? M or W can never get out of the box between 0 and minus 1, because if W is less than 0, then dW dt is positive, and so it pushes it out. And if W is greater than 1, then dW dt is negative, and it pushes it in. So W is always confined between 0 and 1. And it turns out that, of course, based on this, you can see that V is always going to be confined between the reversal potential of calcium and the reversal potential of potassium. Yes?
Maybe during oscillation you just retrace one of those lines back and forth.
Oh, here, these are, I guess, do you guys know what null clines are or not? Oh. Do they have any colored chalk here at all or not? No colored. Okay, well then I'll have to change line types. I'll have to resort to different line types. All right. Okay, well this is good. This is my first... my first aside. All right, If you have a dynamical system, a planar dynamical system, and you want to understand what the solutions look like qualitatively, one way you can do that is as follows. You can break the break it into a series, a grid, okay? And in each grid point, evaluate F and G, okay? Evaluate F and G at that grid point. All right, that tells you what direction dx dt is, and that tells you, that gives you a value for dx dt and a value for dy dt. So that gives you a little vector that you can associate with that point. Okay? And what you do is you fill that thing, you fill the space with those little vectors. That's called a direction field. And it tells you which way everything is going. So it's basically giving you local directions where to go. So if I go here, it means I'm supposed to go up to the right. Now maybe I get here, I'm supposed to go down. And so from that, you can qualitatively see where things are going to go. All right? So that's direction fields. But often, and that's a pain in the neck. You don't want to have to break your space into 100 different points and evaluate F and G and everything. That's what computers are for. Instead, what you're really interested in is whether things are going up, going to the left, going to the right, and so on and so forth. So what you do is you want to break your space, your phase plane, into regions where dx dt is positive, dy dt is positive, dx dt is negative, and so on and so forth. So what you need to know is exactly when dx dt changes sign and dy dt changes sign. And when do they change sign? They change sign when f and g are zero. Okay, so when f is zero, if you draw the curve, if we draw the curve f of x, y equals zero, we might get a curve that looks like that. And everything up here, dx dt is negative. And everything down here, dx dt is positive. You also can draw a curve g is zero, and maybe that looks like this. Okay, and everything above the curve here, dt is negative, and everything below dy dt is positive. So in here, you have everybody positive. Along here, this is zero. So these curves allow you to figure out, drawing those null lines allows you to qualitatively figure out what's going on. Furthermore, the intersections of these curves tell you what the equilibrium points or fixed points of the dynamical system are. So from this, we have this kind of picture here, and we have our nice limit cycle here. Okay. Now, that picture alone does not prove the existence of a limit cycle, but the following argument does prove the existence of a limit cycle. Suppose that this equilibrium point is an unstable center, or unstable it's unstable with two positive eigenvalues, okay? And suppose all solutions to this are bounded in this box. As we said, all these biophysical models are bounded in a box, okay? Well, then we have a Roach motel. They get in, but they can't get out. In other words, you can draw a little circle around here. Everything has to leave that, okay? And you can draw a big box around here. Everything has to enter it. Everything leaves here. Everything enters it. Where can it go? It has to go to a periodic orbit, at least one periodic orbit. Okay, so that's how why planar systems are great. You can use them to prove the existence of periodic orbits just by noting that if you have one unstable equilibrium point only, and that's the only equilibrium point, and everything is bounded in, then you have to have a limit cycle. Okay? So that's what's great about planar systems. That's not true in non-planar systems. In three-dimensional systems, you can get chaos and all that nasty crap. Okay. So anyway, back to here. The Morris-Lecar system, the null lines look like this. And there's limit cycles like that. And in the T-type current, it's exactly the opposite of that. Well, it's just like that, okay? So there the oscillation goes this direction instead in the T-type current model, all right? And the intuition, if you want any biological intuition for this, okay, H is an inactivation variable. It's inactivation of the calcium channels. And when the voltage is high, they become inactivated. Okay, so when the voltage is high, they're inactivated and you lose your calcium current. So the voltage shoots down, you lose the voltage, it shoots across here, goes down, becomes negative, the voltage becomes very negative. Now the voltage is negative, these channels recover again, and we can shoot back up again. And that completes the cycle. Okay? So this is sort of the T-type current nuclines. You can get the same nuclines from this just by flipping the picture upside down. Okay, so this is sort of qualitatively how oscillations arise in these models. I mean, it's showing you where the oscillations are in these models. It's not showing you how they arise. That's a little more complicated, and that involves using bifurcation theory. All right, and so you have to pick a parameter, and the typical parameter that people pick for these things is the current. Okay, I, the injected current. So here you are, you're an experiment. That's one of the only things you can easily control. So here I am, an experimentalist. I stick an electrode into my cell, and I start to turn on the current. And what I do is I watch what happens. And what you see happens is nothing happens. The potential goes up. And then suddenly, you start to see the onset of oscillations. Okay? So how can oscillations occur? And the way to study that mathematically is to take these models and compute what's called a bifurcation diagram. It's funny, 6 hours seems like a whole lot of time, but I'm going to get about 6 pages of my notes. Anyway, if I'm moving too slow, do tell me. But I want to get through the bifurcation stuff because that's important. All right, so here's the idea. Pick a parameter. In this case, I'm going to take, for example, current. And you plot, say, voltage as a function of the current. Now, everybody here, have you guys heard of the Fitch-Nagumo equations? Okay, that's sort of a classic model. The Hodgkin-Huxley equations you've heard of as well. Now, both Fitch-Nagumo and Hodgkin-Huxley have basically the same bifurcation structure, which is why Fitch-Nagumo made the Fitch-Nagumo equations, because they wanted to make something that looked like the Hodgkin-Huxley equations. And that's as follows, okay? You have a branch of equilibrium points that's stable, okay? So as I increase the current, of course, the resting potential goes up because, you know, I'm injecting current. That becomes unstable, okay? And I'm going to continue to draw it like this. And then it restabilizes again at really high currents. Because what happens is at high currents, you completely inactivate the sodium channels, and it goes to a stable fixed point, and you just sit up there, okay? So that's what happens in the Hodgkin-Huxley. But what happens in between? This equilibrium point, this rest state, is unstable. So although you can mathematically find it, you'll never physically find it. All right? You can't get to it because it's unstable. Unstable in the sense that if you're perturbed near it, you'll go flying off somewhere. Okay? It's like a necktie. All right, necktie has two equilibrium points, one down here and one like this, but this one's unstable. If you can stabilize that, you don't need Viagra. It's a little joke. In fact, this is an even better joke. You can stabilize it if you jiggle it up and down fast enough, as anybody knows about parametric resonance. Anyway, enough with that. I just want to see if you guys are still awake. What happens at these points in the Hodgkin-Huxley and the Fitch-Nagumo? Let me write HH here and Fitch-Nagumo. What happens? Does anybody know? Some of you guys probably know. These become unstable through something called a Hopf bifurcation. Okay? Hopf bifurcation. Let me do a little aside on that. The Hopf bifurcation theorem is also called the Poincaré bifurcation or the Andronov bifurcation, depending on whether you're French or Russian. Okay? But most people in the U.S. and in Western Europe call it the Hopf bifurcation theorem. And what it is it tells you that if you have an equilibrium point, and as you change a parameter, the eigenvalue, the stability of that equilibrium point changes. It goes from stable to unstable via a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues going from negative real parts to positive real parts. Okay? Then the Hopf bifurcation theorem tells you you should expect to find in the neighborhood of that parameter a small amplitude periodic solution. Okay, a small amplitude isolated limit cycle. It's the only general tool that we have in all of dynamical systems to rigorously prove the existence of periodic systems, periodic orbits in general dynamical systems. Okay, it is the only way we have that's really simple to verify. Okay, there's lots of other ways to get oscillations, but this is the easiest thing because it's a local result. It only requires knowing something about the eigenvalues at the equilibrium point. Hopf bifurcations can come in two flavors, okay, subcritical and supercritical. All right, subcritical and supercritical. So let me draw a very simple picture here. I'm going to draw a parameter along here, an equilibrium point, and the magnitude of the oscillation. Okay? This is the magnitude of the oscillation. This is supercritical. And this is subcritical. Okay? Now, I've drawn dotted and dashed lines. Solid lines mean stable, and dashed lines mean unstable. What happens with the supercritical is you get the appearance of small amplitude, stable periodic solutions. Okay? And in subcritical, you get small amplitude, unstable periodic solutions. And what happens in neural models is that these things never, they always turn around like this and stabilize. So you get a picture that looks like this in neural models. What this means is that you get large amplitude periodic orbits when you cross this equilibrium point. Yeah?
Just to ask a question.
Yeah?
Just to ask a question. You start asking questions.
I'm sorry, what?
Just to start asking questions. You say neural models, they always turn around. How do you show that?
You don't. They don't. Okay, here's what you can show, okay? Here's what you can show. In planar neural models, if you have this picture, then there and everything's bounded, you have to have a large amplitude periodic orbit. Okay? So it has to come from somewhere. It may not die like this. It may die other ways. But I'm saying that not as a mathematician. I'm saying that as a, I'm saying that in practice, I've never seen one that didn't turn around. How's that? So this is a folk theorem. Okay? All right, so what happens in the Hodgkin-Huxley is it turns out that the oscillations that you get are subcritical, they're unstable, and they turn around and become a large amplitude periodic orbit. So you have a picture that looks like this. Now let me make some sense of this. What it says, everywhere you see these solid lines up here, these this is the maximum and minimum of a periodic orbit, okay? So you get this big periodic orbit, all right? And these are fixed points. This is an unstable periodic orbit, and this is a stable periodic orbit right here. So you notice, for example, in this particular region, right here, in this interval of currents, you have a stable fixed point, and you have a stable oscillation. And John Renzel and Rita Guttmann in the 80s, or 70s, late 70s, tuned the squid axon to this region, and then by injecting pulses, carefully timed transient pulses, they could switch it between on and oscillating. They could kill the oscillation and then start it up again. Okay, so they had a switch between two states. Okay, so you have bistability here. This is very important. Incidentally, there's an apocryphal story about a guy, a Canadian cardiac researcher, that was studying phase resetting in hearts. And he was doing it using his own heart as an example. And he shocked himself into, presumably, this regime. But he didn't know enough dynamical systems to know to shock himself out of it, and he died. So you really should know dynamical systems. There's another story too. This is not dynamical systems. One of my Russian students told me about this during the revolution. This guy was going across lines, and these revolutionary guys captured him, and they were going to kill him. And he says, no, I work at a university, I'm a mathematician. And it turns out one of the revolutionaries was a mathematician also. And so he thought this guy was lying. So he gave him an integral to do, and he did it, so they let him live. But so I tell this to my calculus students, that you really should learn to integrate, because you never know when it might actually come up to be important. Okay, so in with the subcritical Hopf in most neural models, you have bistability. Now, the really beautiful thing about bifurcation theory is that it's a local theory, and that you can learn a whole lot about the local system by analyzing what happens in the neighborhood here, and you can write down a set of simple nonlinear equations called the normal form equations that tell you all about the local behavior here. I won't go into normal forms. You should go get yourselves a book on dynamical systems and read about normal forms. I recommend my favorite book for local bifurcation analysis is by Yuri Kuznetsov. Okay, and it's a great book. I use it to teach, and it's just the best book out there for normal forms and local bifurcation analysis. There's no other book that's anywhere close to this. If you've ever used Guckenheimer and Holmes, it was a groundbreaking book. It was the first one of its kind, but it's totally useless for teaching if you've ever tried to teach out of it. I'm sorry, what?
What does it mean when
you're oscillating? Oh, that's doing this. Okay, so it's spiking repetitively. Okay, so that's and Hodgkin classified neurons that had this kind of behavior. He didn't treat it as bifurcation at all, but these kinds of oscillations have certain behavior. First of all, if you plot the frequency as a function of the current, there's nothing, and then at some finite current, there's a band of frequencies, and then it terminates so that you get the frequency as a function of current looks like this. There's a jump, and then they appear at finite frequency, sometimes a pretty high frequency, and then disappear. Okay? So this is called class 2 excitability. And there's all kinds of other properties that you can get if you read, for example, the chapter that Renzel and I wrote. It tells all about class 2 excitability and some of the properties and how you can infer all those from the nonlinear dynamics. All right, Now, other models, for example, every single cortical model that I have ever analyzed, every single cortical model from the literature, Traub's model, McCormick and Huguenard's model, Wang-Buzaki model, if you take away all the currents except for the fast currents, the sodium and the delayed rectifier, they have a different bifurcation. And it's a rather interesting one. V versus I, here's what it looks like. You have a fixed point, a branch of fixed points. This terminates at a saddle node, okay? Saddle node point, that's where two equilibria come together and annihilate, all right? It's called a saddle node. And there's another branch of equilibria up here, which becomes stabilized at high currents, okay? Now, if you inject a hell of a lot of current, you'll find that this actually comes back like that, okay? But for practical purposes, you might as well treat it like this, okay? So now you can ask yourself what happens. Incidentally, for Traub's standard model with his standard parameters, this point occurs at I equals about 300 microamps per centimeter squared. And by then, the neuron is firing at about 500 to 600 hertz. So this, for all practical purposes, is irrelevant to any of the dynamics that happen in vivo. Okay? You have to inject a hell of a lot of current. This is relevant for other models. And in fact, it does show up in some cortical models. This point up here is really relevant. I had a student this summer, or this fall, spring, whatever it was, the last season, this term, she was looking at what happens out here, because it turns out that in low magnesium waves in cortical slices, certain oscillations terminate because of inactivation of sodium channels. And so we were getting a burster that's based on that, but that's a different story. What happens out here is really cool, okay? All right. You get this branch of periodic orbits, okay, right here? Big branch of periodic orbits, and it terminates on this equilibrium point, okay? So let me rip this thing out of phase space and give you a little circle, all right? So we have a circle. So out here we just have a circle, and things are flitting around very nicely. All right. At this critical point, I star, what happens is a fixed point appears on that circle. Okay? It's stable in one direction and unstable in the other direction. Okay? So this is an I greater than I star, I equal I star, and for I less than I star, amazingly enough, this circle, this invariant circle persists, and you get a pair of fixed points that look like this. Okay? So this is a stable equilibrium point. This is an unstable saddle. And in here you have a center, an unstable center that comes out like that. Okay? So what happens is the oscillations terminate at this fixed point, but they terminate not as small amplitude oscillations, but as real big oscillations. Furthermore, if you look at the frequency versus current, okay? Those of you who have zip drives will recognize this as I omega. little computer joke. Sorry, I can't help it. I have I suffer from something. It's a disease. You can look it up. Mitzelsucht. You can look this up in Dorland's Medical Dictionary. It's a disease where you make lots of stupid puns and you're endlessly amused by your own humor. Okay, so you can look it up. All right. It is. Look it up. Go out on the web and look it up. All right. All right. The frequency is a function of I. Looks like this. You can get arbitrarily low firing rates as you approach this critical thing. And furthermore, omega is approximately, it goes like square root of I minus I star. So the frequency goes to zero like the square root. Right? So you get really sensitive dependence on currents at this point because this has infinite slope at the origin. So you really get a whole lot of amplification of small amounts of noise. This has many profound consequences. This thing near this point is not very sensitive to noise. If you put noise in there, the frequency doesn't change by a whole lot. If you put noise in this, the frequency changes vastly more than it does here. You get very high coefficient of variation in these models when there's noise. Okay? So the frequency looks like this. And I'm going to write down the normal form for this so that you guys can have an exercise to do. The normal form for this, you can think of this as a differential equation on a circle. Okay? The normal form for this, theta dot equals 1 minus cosine theta plus 1 plus cosine theta, I minus I star. Okay? So that's what it looks like. This is proven in 1984, believe it or not. It's a relatively recent result, 1984, by Nancy Capel and me. We were using it for something completely different, but it was actually a lemma that turned out to be more useful as a theorem for other things than what we originally used it for. Okay, so for this, what you can prove, and here's what you can try and do. One periodic orbit of this is theta going from 0 to 2 pi. So evaluate the integral here and show that the period of this thing goes as 1 over the square root of this, and therefore the frequency goes as square root. All right, so that's a little exercise for you to amuse yourselves with. All right, so this is the normal form for this equation. And it suggests a really nice little model for neural excitability to replace the integrate and fire model if you want, okay? Because it's much more, you can quantitatively relate it to, this actually has, I should say, there's parameters in front of here and here, okay? Parameters in front of that. And you can quantitatively relate this to the original differential equation, the original biophysical model. You can directly derive it from that. Okay? I won't go through the derivation at all, but you can get that from that. And this is a really nice little model because it's continuous. You don't have any resetting or anything like that. The only thing you have to do is make sure that theta is mod 2 pi. But it's automatic because you've got cosines here. Anyway. So this is called the theta model. I call it the theta model. Eugene Izakevich calls it the Ehrmantraut-Capel canonical model, which is too long for me. So I'm going to call it the theta model. All right. So I've got one more bifurcation diagram to show you because that turns out to be rather important as well. And the last, and it's a variation of this, all right? Variation of this. And this one occurs, the last one I'm going to draw, occurs in various and sundry pancreatic bursting cells, okay? Everybody know the pancreas? That's the part that you make sweetbreads. You ever have sweetbreads? People can't get them anymore. It was one of my favorite foods as a kid. You get these sweetbreads. It's the pancreas of the cow. And they're wrapped in bacon, and you bake them. Oh, they're so good. It's a German or Pennsylvania Dutch. You ever hear of that? That's part of Pennsylvania that's in the It's called Dutch, but it's really Deutsch. It's German. They speak this weird dialect of German there. And it's a really popular thing. That and head cheese, you've probably heard of head cheese, right? Head cheese is, and pork snout, really good stuff. Sausages, all that stuff. You ever see Texas Chainsaw Massacre? Anybody see that? Because they, these guys used to make head cheese, but they didn't use pigs. Anyway, the bifurcation diagram for this last model looks like this. The periodic orbit comes in like this. Periodic orbit, instead of dying on this saddle node, it dies on this saddle point. Okay? And this is a really important bifurcation. It's called a homoclinic bifurcation. And those of you, it seems all the physicists I know love chaos. And if you love chaos, then homoclinics are your boy, because whenever there's homoclinics, there's chaos. Well, there's chaos lurking about. Let me draw you sort of a phase plane of what happens as we go from one to the other. Okay? So, we'll call... This would be none of the... Morris-Lecar under some... In fact, all three of these bifurcation diagrams can be found in the Morris-Lecar equations, depending on what the parameters are. If you want to play with them, and I really urge you to do so, go onto my website and find the tutorial on our chapter on numerical or on excitability. Because in that tutorial, it has the Morris-Lecar equation set up for you, and it has all the parameters for each one of these kinds of pictures. Okay? And it even tells you how to download software to track the bifurcation diagrams. If you're interested in dynamical systems software, you can download my package, which is free, and it has built into it auto, it has lots of animation stuff, and it solves differential equations, delay equations, Volterra integral equations and algebraic, differential algebraic equations, anything in dynamical systems you probably want to do, you can do with it. It's free, and it compiles on any Unix system, and you can download a Windows version of it too if you have a if you want. But you need to download also an X server for Windows, which you can download for nothing these days. Got an ugly interface, but it's pretty easy to write the equations in. In any event, you can download that and do all these pictures if you want, using auto, which is a great bifurcation package. All right, so let me show you what happens here. Down in this region, right here, there's three fixed points, 1, 2, 3, okay? At this region, there's still three fixed points. And in this region, there's still three fixed points. So I'm only interested in this region where there's three fixed points. And I want to show you what happens as we go from here to here. Okay? Because in here, there's oscillations. Okay? So what happens? Okay, I've drawn particular sets here, particular trajectories, okay? Those of you who don't know much dynamical systems, this is a saddle point, and this is the unstable manifold. This is the set of trajectories who, if you go backwards in time, will end up back here, okay? This is the stable manifold. That's the set of trajectories that, if you go forward in time, will end up on this fixed point. All right, so this is called a saddle point. It looks like that. This sort of looks like an alien head. You ever see the aliens in like Weekly World News or the Globe or any of those cool? Well, you probably don't read those, but I do. I get all my news and opinions from those magazines. Anyway, this sort of looks like the aliens. They always show you that we're abducted by Elvis or vice versa. All right, So as I change, this is for I less than I star. So what's going to happen as I change I, as I change the current, okay, is this trajectory and this trajectory. Right now, this trajectory is inside and this one's outside, okay? What's going to happen is they're going to exchange places, okay? And they're going to shed off a limit cycle when they do that, right? But the point at which they exchange places, they're looped together like this, okay? So what happens at I critical is we have this picture. Okay, so we have this picture at I equals I critical. Notice that there's a limit cycle here, but it never actually reaches this one. It spins out to it. It never actually reaches it and has infinite period, right? Because it's going to take longer and longer because you're hanging out by this equilibrium point. And in fact, the period goes logarithmically. The period goes logarithmically at the distance you are away from here. All right, and that again, that's an easy elementary exercise that you can find in Kuznetsov's book, or you can try and do it yourselves. Okay. Finally, for I greater than I critical, what happens? Okay, where these two came together, and now for I greater than I critical, it looks like this. I always draw this thing too damn fat. Alright, so there's what it looks like. Okay, so this is for I bigger than I critical and before you reach this point. Okay, so what happens is really cool. You now have bistability again. Okay, you have two different equilibrium. You have two different possible equilibrium states. One's a fixed point, asymptotically stable fixed point, and the other is this oscillation up here. Okay, spinning around. Get this nice oscillation. And how do you get to this oscillation? If you're at this fixed point, you have to give it a kick that kicks it in between these two guys. All right, because if you kick it into these two guys, then everything in those guys gets sucked into this limit cycle. If you kick it past these guys, boom, you end up back at the fixed point. If you kick it less than that, it goes back like this. So solutions look like this and like that. Okay? This is why I didn't want to use the computer, because you can't sort of draw these dynamically. Okay, so basically, these are the three kinds of diagrams that you commonly see in membrane models, locally in the onset and loss of repetitive oscillations. Okay? This one you see in pancreatic bursting cells, and you also see in the Morris-Lecar equations in exactly the same parameter regime as you see this, but when you make the recovery variable, that W, the potassium variable, if you make that faster, then you get this picture. Okay? So now, let's use these ideas to talk about bursters. And then after bursters, maybe we'll take a break, because then I can start talking about, maybe I will get all this stuff done. All right. Do you have any questions so far? All right. We've gone through three different dynamics mechanisms of oscillations. We have the hop bifurcation, we have the saddle node on a limit cycle bifurcation, and we have this homoclinic bifurcation. All right? The homoclinic and the saddle node are global bifurcations, but you can do local analysis on them. And the reason you can do local analysis on them is because you can focus in what's going on here, and up here you can focus on what's going on around here. Let me say one more thing about homoclinic bifurcations. Here is sort of a very simplified picture of what happens with a homoclinic. X dot equals X y dot equals minus a y. Okay? There's a saddle point at zero. All right? Things move away like this here, and they come back in here. All right? So think of your fixed point here, and consider the following. To understand what happens in a homoclinic orbit, it's very simple. What you do is you start with some trajectory, say here, start with here. You map it out. It's going to get squeezed down here, and then you say, okay, when I hit here, I'm just going to reflect it back up to here, okay, and bring you back down. Okay, so I'm going to make this little map. I'm just going to map this interval to this interval. In other words, I'm going to sort of hand wave my way around what happens here. Because once I get past that, the system's no longer linear. All right, so this allows me to make a map of what's going on. And what's really neat is you can show that there's a limit cycle under certain circumstances. All right. Depending on how you define this mapping, there's a limit cycle. And furthermore, you can determine whether that limit cycle is stable or not. And the limit cycle, the stability of the limit cycle depends on whether A is less than 1 or bigger than 1. Okay? So if you add up the eigenvalues, what are the eigenvalues for this two-dimensional system? 1 and minus A. 1 minus A, if that's positive, then the limit cycle you get is unstable. And if that's negative, the limit cycle you have is stable. So you can do all the stability of these limit cycles and their existence basically from using this local analysis. Okay? So it's really kind of cool. And that's what the beauty of bifurcation in theory is you can do everything with local analysis. All right, let me say one more word about the let me say one more word about homoclinics, okay? And this has to do with chaos, all right? If you take a homoclinic trajectory and you periodically drive it near a homoclinic, what happens? Well, if you periodically drive it, what you can do is you can... Here, let's consider the following thing. And since I'm going to have to bring this in eventually, I probably will have to bring this in eventually. Does everybody here know what a Poincaré map is? Okay, a Poincaré map, let's take a periodic system. All right, what we'll do is at every period, we'll take a snapshot of where we are in time. Okay? So let's take things near this. Let's take this homoclinic. Okay? We have this nice homoclinic orbit. And we aren't doing anything periodically. We haven't forced it. We've turned the forcing strength to zero, but we're going to take a snapshot. We'll get a series of points along here. Okay? 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 Depending on where our initial conditions were. So if we take all possible initial conditions, it'll fill this in. So the Poincaré map looks exactly that the Poincaré map gives rise to a discrete dynamical system because we're only it's a map, okay? So we're only looking at it at discrete intervals in time. So that also has a stable and unstable manifold, and in absence of any coupling, that looks the same as the unstable and stable manifold here, okay? But now let's turn the coupling on a little bit. This will get perturbed. And what happens is that you have the unstable manifold here, or the stable manifold here, and the unstable manifold here. This gets perturbed, and what happens is this can come around and intersect this, not in a tangential way, but transversely. Transversely is a mathematician's way of saying if you have a knife and you graze somebody against the skin, that's not transversal. But if you stab them in the heart, that's transversal. Transversality is that, okay? So this trajectory hits like that. What you can prove is if you do one time like this, you have to do infinitely many times. And they all accumulate there, okay? So now you have this weird map which has infinitely many intersections. And now this is what's really cool. I just going on a tangent because it's such a beautiful theory. I'm not expecting any of you to completely understand what's going on, but I'm trying to motivate where the chaos comes from. All right. So you have this map that has all these little wiggles in it. All right. Everybody, see, you have to have all. If it has to intersect infinitely many times, it has to accumulate. All right. So you have this map with all these wiggles. This is a map. So what you can imagine is what happens when you map a little piece of a rectangle here onto this. You can start to get self-intersections. So what you find when you periodically force things near a homoclinic is you find, for example, if you take the square gets stretched by the homoclinic and folded because it gets curled over. So you get a map that takes this thing into something that looks like that. All right, so this is the image of this rectangle under our map. And if you apply that again, of course, it goes back and forth like this. And if you do this infinitely many times, which is what's going to happen as you iterate the map in time, you get all this sequence of segments here. These things look like canner sets and are called snail horseshoes. Okay, and the snail horseshoe was the first example of an explicitly demonstrable chaotic system. So the bottom line here, the moral of this is, the only general theorem I know of where you can rigorously prove the existence of chaos in a particular dynamical system involves this structure of periodically driving something near a homoclinic orbit. And it turns out to be really easy to determine whether you get this so-called transverse intersection. All you have to do is evaluate a simple integral. And for some example systems, that integral can be explicitly evaluated, and so you can rigorously prove chaos in certain classes of equations. Otherwise, you can numerically evaluate this integral. If you want to know more about it, go find Kuznetsov's book and look up Melnikov. Okay, another Russian guy. Okay, and this Melnikov integral tells you, yes? I'm sorry, what? I can't. This is a periodically forced two-dimensional system. So this is the Poincaré map of this is a two-dimensional map. This can happen with a two-dimensional discrete dynamical system. You can have self-intersection of the manifold. Because this is a map. This is not a flow. This is not the dynamics of the ODE. This is the dynamics of the map that's being periodically driven by the ODE. Here's a way to mollify you. All right, think of time in this direction. We're periodically driving it so that when we don't project down in the map space, then that's really not violating intersection of trajectories. Okay, but in map space, because everything's mod 2 pi, we do have these intersections. Okay? All right. Yes? I'm sorry, what?
What is the definition of homoclinic bifurcation? How do you define homoclinic
bifurcation? I'm sorry, I can't. Wait, one at a time. Somebody tell me what he's.
How do I define a homoclinic bifurcation?
A homoclinic bifurcation is one in which the stable manifold and the unstable manifold intersect. Okay? They come together like this. All right? And incidentally, there's all kinds of really cool homoclinic bifurcations that occur in three dimensions. For example, you can have something that's got a spiral coming in, okay, and has a one-dimensional saddle going out. And so you can get a homoclinic that looks like this. Okay? And this gives rise to all kinds of complicated behavior called Shilnikov chaos and Shilnikov behavior. Right? And you find this in the action potentials of nerve axons in the Hodgkin-Huxley equations, or Morse-Lacar, or Fitzsimmons-Nagumo. And it's why you can get multiple pulses and all kinds of things like that. Anyway, I don't want to spend too much more time on chaotic stuff. Although Kleinfeld said, these are physicists, you can talk about chaos. Whenever I talk about stuff at Woods Hole, I never talk about chaos because it's mostly biologists. And I don't like chaos. I mean, I don't dislike it. I'm just too stupid to understand it, so I don't deal with it. Oscillations is the extent of which I feel competent to comment on. Anyway, now let's talk a little bit about bursters and then we'll take a break. All right? Many kinds of neurons have bursting behavior. Okay? That is to say, when you inject current, rather than firing like this, they fire like this. Okay? And Rinzel and Wong and Rinzel and Sherman made a nice classification of some of the more common bursters. Incidentally, Eugene Izakevich has refined that classification in a paper which he classifies all 128 species of bursters. But the ones that one finds in biology, there's about three or four of them. And that's all I'm going to talk about. Okay? And they all have stupid names. That if you've ever done PDEs will confuse you endlessly. There's elliptic bursters, and there's parabolic bursters, and there's square wave bursters, and there's triangular bursters. Okay? And they're called these names for different reasons. Okay? The elliptic burster is called that way because the shape of its solutions. The elliptic burster, the bursts look like this. Okay, so their envelope sort of looks elliptical, all right, looks like an ellipse. Okay, so that's the elliptic burster. The parabolic burster, oh, I've drawn it backwards. The parabolic burster is called parabolic because the inner spike interval times, when you plot them on a curve, looks like a parabola. Okay? The square wave burster is called a square wave burster because when you plot the voltage, it looks like a square wave. Okay? So that's what I mean. And the triangular one, the same thing. If you plot it, it looks like a... triangular burster is called a triangular burster because it looks sort of like a triangle. All right, so don't go by the names, all right? This is one thing that Izakevich has pointed out. He says you shouldn't call them these stupid names. You should talk about them because of the way they occur, okay, from the nonlinear dynamics perspective. So let's talk about bursting. Let's talk about the elliptic burster first, okay? Let's talk about the elliptic burster. Now, this sort of thing, I suppose you could fool around and get a dynamical system that would do this in the plane, but it's pretty hard to do this in the plane, and it's much easier to do this with a three-dimensional system. All right, now how can we get such a system? All right, how can we get this so-called elliptic burster? All right, let's suppose we have a system which undergoes a Hopf bifurcation, and it's a subcritical Hopf bifurcation, so we have bistability. All right? Now, rather than a current as a parameter, I'm going to introduce another parameter. I'm going to introduce a whole different current into the Morse-Lacar equations. All right? And the reason I'm going to do that is because it makes it a lot easier. I'm going to stop shortly, Sebastian, for a break. Bye. CdV dt equals minus GLL minus GL V minus EL minus GK W V minus EK minus GCA M infinity of V V minus ECA. I'm going to add a current, just an injected current. I'm going to add another cool, I'm going to add one more current. current, and this is a current that I'm sure that, I don't know if Kleinfeld, did anybody discuss the panoply of different ionic currents in membrane models? Oh, really? Oh, well. Well, I'm going to introduce another one, okay, which I will call GAHP, okay? And it has the following form. Huh? Oh, writing's getting pretty small? Okay. This is GAHP times intracellular calcium divided by intracellular calcium plus calcium. It's a standard Michaelis-Menten type of model for calcium concentration. Okay? Now, this is calcium. We have to put an equation in for calcium. Okay? What's the equation for calcium? Ca dot equals. I'm going to put a tau in front of here so I can cover my ass. Everybody, you always put a tau in there so you can cover your, oh, that's a good joke. Yeah. You come out of the gym, you want a tau so you cover. Never mind. All right, here's my dynamics for calcium, all right? Intracellular calcium, all right? It has some time constant tau. The rate of change of calcium is the amount of calcium that comes into the cell. Now, what's ICA? This is ICA right here, right? That's the current due to calcium. GCA, M infinity of V, V minus ECA. So this is ICA right here, all right? And decay of calcium. All right? So that's it. So now, what happens? This is a potassium current, all right, which means that it's going to pull the membrane potential down. So let's suppose the neuron's spiking wildly. Okay, what's going to happen? As the neuron spikes wildly, calcium's going to build up in the cell. All right? Because calcium's coming into the cell. It's building up. All right? As it builds up, this potassium current builds up. Right? Going to shut it down. Shuts down, the cell can't fire anymore, all the calcium decays away, and it starts a cycle again. So, if you can get bursting by introducing a slow parameter that takes you back and forth across the bifurcation diagram. Now let me show you, suppose tau is really big, okay? If tau is big, then calcium is basically constant. All right, everybody see that? Because if I divide by tau, dCA dt is small, okay? And if dCA dt is small, it doesn't change much. So let's treat it as a parameter, and let's plot what the bifurcation diagram of this particular model looks like as a function of calcium treated as a parameter. Okay? Yes, Sebastian.
So we didn't actually cover calcium currents.
Huh?
We didn't cover other currents in detail at all. So I just wanted to ask one physical question. So how can we actually keep track of calcium concentration, but you don't have to keep track of sodium and potassium concentration?
Oh, because the intracellular calcium is probably the most highly regulated ion in any cell. Calcium does everything, okay? It does. I mean, calcium is responsible for all kinds of crap that happens in mitosis. It's responsible for all the molecular motors that cause cells to move and grow. It's responsible for all kinds of stuff. So that calcium is extremely well regulated. And near the membrane, the resting calcium is 10 to the minus 4th millimolar or so. It's really low. Calcium is very, very low normally. So the smallest amount of calcium that comes in makes a big change in the effect of calcium on the dynamic. So because there's so little calcium, a little bit coming in makes a big difference. There's a hell of a lot more. The net change in sodium concentration during an action potential relative to what the sodium was already there is very, very small compared to that of calcium. So you have to keep track. In fact, if you do this properly, you can write the calcium ECA in terms of the Nernst equations as well, or use the constant field. We don't do that because it's just much easier to not do that. And this is just a convenient way of modeling this. But properly, you should also include calcium in here as well. Okay? I'm sorry, what?
There's no cooperativity in the calcium binding?
No. This is, you could put cooperativity. See, this guy knows too much. that's the danger. All right, this is a pedagogical lecture. I'm not publishing this stuff. The point is, yes, you can put, here, we can put this to make Sebastian happy. We'll put a cooperativity parameter. But it doesn't matter, it won't matter in the bottom line in the mechanism. Okay? So we'll make P equal to 1 with little loss in generality. I won't say without loss in generality, but with WLLOG. Okay? Mathematicians love WLOG. That's a really famous mathematician's talk. Without loss of generality, all parameters are 1, okay? Anyway, so let's draw the bifurcation diagram of this, the homoclinic guy. Suppose we're in the regime, I said elliptic. We'll do the elliptic as a function of CA. Okay, treating it as a parameter. Okay, we know for high CA that the neuron has to be at rest. Okay, because at high calcium here, okay, this after hyperpolarization is turned on a lot, okay? And that's killing, that's like injecting a big negative current, okay? Everybody see that? And at low calcium, this isn't there, and we'll inject enough current to make this neuron active. So this is what the bifurcation diagram as a function of calcium looks like. Okay? So we still have our friend bistability here, okay? And so what's going to happen is the calcium, if you choose parameters like mu and GAHP and CA naught and I correctly, what you can get to happen is as follows, okay? We'll start up spiking, okay? So we're spiking away. As we spike, calcium builds up. Calcium builds up, what happens? It builds up and this limit cycle disappears. We can't fire repetitively anymore. All right, everybody see? So we collapse, bam. All right, now the calcium, there's nothing spiking, there's no production of calcium anymore because there's no neuron spiking. Calcium has to start to decay. So it decays, pulls in here, it starts to decay down, then it starts to build up again because this fixed point's unstable. You go beyond that, the fixed point's unstable, it can't persist. Bam! We fire up the gear again, all right, and we start the cycle. All right, so we get this nice elliptic burster. It goes back and forth. All right? Same thing with the square wave burster. All right? Huh?
How can you know the movement of the trajectory? Because, well, at the beginning you say, well, we go to the left and it grows, and then, well, we touch the top or the bottom, and then it goes to the left, and then higher, 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 and then you go back to the right.
Right.
How can you determine this mathematically? I mean, how can you predict this?
It depends on all the parameters, of course. You can get it can hang up here, or it can hang out down here. But if you adjust the parameters, and you can figure these out quantitatively by looking at the average dynamics of ICA as a function of this, okay? And then you can figure out where to choose your parameters so you can get it to burst. This is, your question is completely legitimate. I'm hand waving here, but you can easily, once you have this structure, it's a matter of just fooling around with a few parameters to get it to burst. Okay? Square wave bursting is a similar phenomena. Okay, we have the same picture here as we had before. But the periodic orbit dies at this homoclinic, remember? Okay, so the periodic orbit dies at the homoclinic, and now once again, here's calcium along here. At low calcium, okay, the neuron doesn't spike, so the potential builds up. Then what happens is it builds up so much this fixed point disappears, and you're left with this oscillation here and here. And then you run into this homoclinic, and you come back down like that, and so that gives you your square wave burster. Okay? So the burster works like that. Now, incidentally, this is really sensitive because there's this damn homoclinic in here. So it's very easy to get chaotic behavior. And it's really fun. You can find regions where there's chaos and do a Poincaré map. For example, a Poincaré map based on the period of the peak of the calcium. All right? And if you do that, you get this really nice, if you look at, you get this really nice one-dimensional map that looks like a cat map. And so you can get all the chaotic behavior, you know, the standard logistic type map. You can get all the stuff you want from looking at this little map. You can't prove anything, but it illustrates it. I should say that Dave Terman has proven the existence of chaos in the square wave burster under certain situations, okay? Because of this homoclinic, you can prove some stuff about what happens. All right? So that's the square wave burster and the elliptic burster. What about the parabolic burster? Will this mechanism work for the parabolic burster? Okay. Well, let me first explain what the local dynamics is, what the dynamics is for the parabolic burster. In that case, unfortunately, it's this. Okay, it looks like that. There's no bistability. So how can we go back and forth between them? We can't. There's no hysteresis. Without hysteresis, you can't go back and forth. It turns out that parabolic bursters require two slow variables. Okay, we have one slow variable for elliptic and square wave bursters. You need two slow variables for these guys. And what you have to do is arrange those slow variables so that there's this underlying slow oscillation. Now what happens if you slowly oscillate between these two? You can see what happens. Over here, there's no firing. And over here, we fire repetitively. But we start out slowly. Remember, because we're crossing this thing. This thing has arbitrary low frequency. We speed up, and then we come back again and slow down, giving us the parabolic profile of the interspike intervals. Okay? So parabolic bursters require two slow variables. All right? And one of them should be an outward current, and the other should be an inward current. And again, you can download the tutorial that we have on this to find specific examples of these kinds of bursters. Okay? So I'm going to stop here for a quick break.
The two slow variables are calling...
Huh?
The two slow variables themselves are an oscillator?
Yes, they oscillate, but they oscillate gated to the voltage of that thing.
So they still need feedback from the
back. Huh? You still need the fast stuff to get the spiking and things. Yes, you do. Okay? So I'll stop here for... How long are the breaks usually?
20 minutes.
20 minutes? That sounds cool. Okay. Okay, do you have any questions so far on membrane models and bifurcations and all that sort of stuff? Everything cool? All right, well now, yeah.
What's a delayed rectified current?
Huh?
You mentioned delayed rectified current as a standard element of the equation.
Oh, delayed rectifier. That's simply the outward potassium current. It's called that because it brings the membrane potential back down, and it's delayed only because it has a slower time course than the other stuff.
Okay.
The biologists like to call all these things all kinds of things. It's just a regular potassium current. They call it the delayed rectifier. There's also an A current. Did they talk about A currents to you guys? A current is another potassium current. There's millions of potassium currents and a bunch of calcium currents. There's basically only two sodium currents that you need to pay attention to. One is the standard transient sodium that you've already seen in Hodgkin-Huxley. And then in some dendrites, there's something called persistent sodium, which has either a very slow or non-existent inactivation. And so it stays on all the time. There's lots of different calcium types, but the only two you really have to pay attention to, you have to pay attention to all of them, but the two main different ones are like a T-type current, which is a transient calcium current and has a low threshold, and the L-type calcium current, which is a high threshold, permanent, persistent calcium current, but has a very high threshold. So the Morris LeCar uses this, has the L-type calcium current, and the T-current model that I alluded to earlier uses the transient T-type current. potassium currents, there's about four different ones that are the most relevant for modelers. There's the delayed rectifier, which is just your standard activating calcium or potassium current. It's activated at high voltage. It activates, the higher the potential, the more active it becomes. There's the after hyperpolarization, which I mentioned already. That's the one that's calcium dependent. So as the calcium goes up, it hyperpolarizes the membrane. There's an M current, muscarinic current. It's sensitive to various and sundry neuromodulators, but it's basically modeled the same way as the delayed rectifier. It just has much slower kinetics. So it's also used for spike frequency adaptation. That's if you inject the current into a neuron, it fires repetitively and then slows down a little bit. Okay, that's called spike frequency adaptation, and you can model that with the M current, the M-type potassium current, or this after hyperpolarization. And finally, there's the A-type calcium or A-type potassium current, which is an inactivating potassium current, so that when you turn the neuron on, okay, this potassium current is active and immediately suppresses the firing of the neuron. So when you inject a current, what you see, if you inject a current like this, what you see with the membrane is you see it go up, and it gradually takes a while to charge, and then it starts to fire repetitively. And that delay is because this potassium current is initially active, but at higher potentials it becomes inactive, and then allows this guy to fire, and of course then the delayed rectifier is what brings the action potential back down. All right, so that's the A current. Again, if you go to my webpage, there's what Dave Pinto calls the Mr. Potato Head model. It's a little model that has about 10 different currents in it. It's just a point neuron with 10 different currents, and you can play with all of them. You can turn them on, turn them off. There's a whole bunch of exercises related to that also on my webpage. Just go find lecture notes in computational neuroscience that I've taught. The downside of that is all the code is written in my own software. So you can probably read the software. You can probably just download the files. They're ASCII files. And the syntax for the differential equations is relatively simple. I think everybody here could figure out that how to interpret what that meant. So the syntax is pretty much like that for all these files. And so you should probably, they're human readable. If you want to convert them to MATLAB or some other proprietary software, you're welcome to. I don't mind MATLAB, except that every November I can't use it for 4 weeks because they always have problems getting the licensing structure right for the university and stuff. It also is 5 or 6 times slower. I don't know why, because I wrote an interpreter too, but I based mine on Forth, a great language. If I've ever heard of Forth, I wrote an Atari 800 graphics program in fourth called Rembrandt. I managed to coach 256 colors out of this thing, where it was only supposed to give you 16, by changing on the horizontal blank. When it came over, I could change the color map on the fly. It was really cool. You know, you get 16 colors on a line, but you can, you know, if you're smart, you can make pretty cool pictures if you kind of vertically organized your thoughts. Anyway, I want to talk about coupling now, all right? Coupling of oscillators, okay, and coupling of neurons and things like that, okay? So that sense of coupling, not the more usual sense. And the first thing I want to talk about is phase response curves. Has anybody here heard of phase response curves? Some of you guys have. All right. If you have an oscillator, all right. Suppose you have something that's firing repetitively, like that, and you come in and you give it a brief stimulus at a time t, since at some time t after the last spike, okay? Then that's going to change when it spikes again, right? So what you might see is you might see the next spike right there. And then without any further perturbation, it continues to fire at the same frequency. All right? So what's happened is instead of firing at this time t, it fired at a time t prime. And we define delta of t to be 1 minus t prime over t. Okay, and that's a function, of course, of t. And that's that map that you get is called the phase response curve, PRC. Tells you how much the phase is advanced or delayed when you hit the limit cycle. Now let me talk a little bit briefly about phase. Limit cycles, when you study the stability of a limit cycle, all right, you know, there's stability, everybody knows about stability of fixed points, okay? When you have a fixed point, the stability is determined by linearizing around that fixed point and looking at the eigenvalues of the associated linear or the associated matrix. Okay? And if all the eigenvalues have negative real parts, then that fixed point is asymptotically stable. If you're talking about maps, then if all the fixed points lie inside the unit circle, then that fixed point is asymptotically stable. Okay, with limit cycles, it's a little more complicated. Okay, when you linearize around a limit cycle, you get a linear equation, but it has periodic coefficients. And if you can study not the eigenvalues of that, but what you can do is you can study something called the Floquet multipliers of that. All right, so what you do is you solve that periodic linear equation. And it turns out you can prove that every equation of the following form, x dot equals a of t x, okay, a of t is periodic. The solutions to this are of the form x of t equals p of t e to the mu t. All right, solutions to this look like that, okay, where p of t is a periodic function, and this is just an exponential, right? And for every n-dimensional thing, there are n different mu's, all right? Those are called the Floquet exponents, all right? So with a limit cycle, stability is guaranteed, but now with a limit cycle, a periodic limit cycle to an autonomous system, you can start that limit cycle anywhere you want, right? That's the whole point of our circadian pacemaker. When you go out in the sun, you change, you move it. You change the time of it because you can shift it. All right? It's not like a fixed point. A fixed point, yeah, you can't move. It sits there. Okay? But a limit cycle, you can move around. It has a certain sloppiness. And that's because when you linearize around a limit cycle, you have a zero flow k exponent, mu. All the other ones, if you have an asymptotically stable limit cycle, all of them have negative real parts. So the limit, you get pressed down to the limit cycle, but there's an arbitrariness to the phase of the limit cycle. And that's going to be crucial in what we're going to talk about next. Because what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about phase models, all right, and coupling of oscillators. And the key thing with these is, let's suppose that we have 10 oscillators and they're uncoupled. Or let's start with 2 oscillators and they're uncoupled. Then we have 2 degrees of freedom for the phase. All right? And that phase lies on a circle, the unit circle. So what is our phase space? We have a cross product of 2 circles. What's the cross product of 2 circles? It's a torus, a 2 torus. Okay? Or a bagel, if you want to. Something that's more intuitive. I used to say donut, but then I had these morons that were thinking cream. They only ate cream donuts. And that's a sphere. So I say bagel now because there's so far nobody's invented a bagel without a hole. So basically, when you have N oscillators, you have an N torus. Okay? S1 cross S1. All right, so you have this torus sitting in phase space, and when you turn on the coupling, that torus gets perturbed, and what we want to do is study the dynamics on that torus. So that's the whole point of coupling oscillators. We want to study the dynamics on the torus that's sitting around there when they're not coupled. When they're uncoupled, there's this torus, and you can turn that coupling on a finite amount, and that torus will persist. It still sticks around, but the dynamics on it changes, and that's what we want to understand. Okay? So there's a couple of ways to approach this, and I'll start with maps, because I know lots of people like maps. Yes?
It's a real number, right?
I'm sorry, what?
Mu
can be a complex number or a real number. In a two-dimensional system, it's always a real number.
Because
there's a zero eigen, they always have to. If you have complex, it has to appear in complex conjugate pairs because it's a real system.
But then we could put the imaginary part in P.
Oh no, because that might not be. I should write this again. P is the same period as the original matrix. If mu is complex, it might be a different, could be an arbitrary period, okay? And so then you can't absorb it into that because it's not periodic anymore. In fact, when the real part goes to zero, you expect a bifurcation of new behavior that's quasi-periodic. And in fact, usually what you find is chaotic behavior and things like that. So, incidentally, as long as we're talking about limit cycles here, I talked mostly about bifurcation of fixed points. You can also have bifurcation of limit cycles. And you can imagine, that from what I said, the real part of mu has to be negative. All right? So what happens? How can the real part of mu has to be negative? And in fact, let's look at, instead of e to the mu t, let's look at something called m equals e to the mu capital T. Okay? So that's after one cycle. All right? This is just a number now. It's a real or a complex number. Okay? So if absolute value of m is less than 1, then the limit cycle will be stable because each time we iterate, we multiply again by each time we go through one period, we multiply by another factor of m, right? So m times m times n, that will collapse to zero. The perturbation will disappear if the absolute value of m is less than 1, okay? So how can m become greater than 1? There are 3 ways in which m can become greater than 1, All right, here's the unit circle. M is going to lie on the, if M is inside the unit circle, then everything collapses, okay? Everybody buy that? If M is outside the unit, because the absolute value of M less than 1, absolute value of M defines a unit circle on a complex plane, right? So how can we lose things? We can go through here, M equals 1, exactly equal to 1. We can go this way, M equals minus 1, or we can go through somewhere else, okay? Everywhere else is complex, okay? When we go through M equals 1, what we expect to see is the appearance or disappearance of limit cycles. So an unstable limit cycle and a stable limit cycle come together, just like an unstable and stable periodic come together in a saddle point. And that's what's happening here. An unstable. So remember we had these bifurcation diagrams where we had, I drew something like this where there's periodic orbits. This is a stable periodic orbit, an unstable orbit. They come together and they annihilate. Okay? So that happens at this point. The saddle point for limit cycles. What happens here? Okay? This is a very interesting bifurcation, and those of you who have studied chaos and things like that probably are aware of it. The limit cycle goes through something called a period doubling. Okay? So you go from something that looks like this to something that looks like this. Okay? So the period doubles. And that's because, think of minus 1 to the n, it takes 2 cycles to come back to where you started. Okay? So that happens when m equals minus 1. And when you go through these guys, that's sort of like a hop bifurcation, but for a map. And you expect complicated stuff in general, but basically in a hand wave sense, what you expect to happen is quasi-periodic behavior, because you have this limit cycle, and then superimposed on that is some other periodic stuff that has a period that's not incommensurate with this. Okay? So you get this, you get the appearance of tori, okay? Quasi-periodic stuff. A period on top of another period. Okay? So those are the kinds of local bifurcations you can expect to see in limit cycles. All right. So now, we know with an autonomous limit cycle, there's always this arbitrariness in phase. And so we have this phase response curve, and this is something that experimentalists can compute. This is easy to calculate. In fact, there's a really lovely paper, a pair of papers by Alex Reyes and Eb Fetz. I don't know, they're in like 94, 95, somewhere around 94, Journal of Neurophysiology. Okay, and they compute the phase response curves for cortical neurons. What they do is the following. They inject current into a single cortical neuron to get it to fire repetitively. And then they briefly perturb it with currents just like this. And they get a beautiful phase response curve that looks like this. Okay, so the phase response curve looks like this. Now, I want to point out some interesting things about this. Yes?
Question about this quals. Is there any way to characterize it with the amplitude of the error?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it depends, of course, on the amplitude.
It might influence the curve. Yeah?
Huh?
It might influence the curve.
Oh, it does. It does influence the curve. If you make the amplitude, but for a range of amplitudes, it looks pretty much similar. It might, but you're absolutely right. I mean, it makes a big difference. It does. The amplitude can make a huge difference. Okay? But for small, I'm going to talk only about small perturbations because most of the applications of phase response curve theory is only valid if you have small amplitude perturbations. Because one of the implicit assumptions is that there's no memory and you immediately get back to where you were. Okay? You were going to say something more, right?
Still, there should be some kind of bounds for, lower bound for width of the pulse in its amplitude in the high bound. Because if it's really small, you won't get any response at all, right?
No, you will get response. You always get a response. It just won't be much. But no, I mean, what you're saying is correct. What you're saying is correct. There are lower and upper bounds. But for practical purposes, I'm just going to assume that you can compute this PRC. And they have done it, and it looks very nice like this. And you can do it analytically, and I'll leave this as an exercise for you, to do it analytically using a delta function, infinitesimally shifting it for the following model. Do it analytically for the integrate and fire, okay? And do it analytically for the radial isochrone clock, also, which has the following equation. R dot equals R as 1 minus R squared, theta dot equals 1, okay? And for that, let me draw the picture here. Suppose we're right here, and we give a perturbation along here, okay? Then the new phase is obtained by just projecting down to here, okay? So you can compute it for that too. And it roughly looks like a sinusoid. So this is the PRC for cortical neuron. You can also compute the PRC for Pteroptix malucci, which is a wonderful animal. It's a firefly, Southeast Asian fireflies. These animals will fill trees in Malaysia and Thailand, and they'll synchronously fire. The whole tree lights up. And if you take an individual insect and you periodically, and you hit it with a strobe light, you can compute the phase response curve. And the PRC for Pteroptix malucci looks basically like this. Okay? You can do the same thing. If you take the curve, you can take the Hodgkin-Huxley equations and compute the phase response curve for the Hodgkin-Huxley equations, and that looks like that or something along those lines. I haven't drawn it completely correctly. Okay? You can take the, this is HH. You can take the situation where we had the saddle node bifurcation on of a limit cycle in the Morris-Lecar, and if you compute the PRC for that, PRC looks like this. Okay? All right. So PRCs come in a whole lot of different varieties. If you take a PRC of Morris-Lecar with spike frequency adaptation, it looks almost exactly like this. And if like this. And in fact, you can take, not the Morris-Lecar, but you can take Traub, the Traub model with spike frequency adaptation, and you can fit this perfectly. Okay? You can fit the PRC perfectly. Yes?
How do you interpret these curves?
I'm sorry, what?
How do you interpret these curves? I mean, there is maximum, and this would be like the, but this evolving in time.
Okay, how do you interpret these curves? That's a very good question, and that's what I want to talk about. Okay, what these curves say is this. Suppose that I give it a perturbation right after it's spiked, then it won't have any effect at all on it. Suppose I give it a perturbation, you know, 10 milliseconds before it's going to spike, then it's going to have a really big effect on it. Okay? Here, if I give it a perturbation, right after it spikes, I actually delay the time at which it spikes again, so I can slow it down. Here, I can speed it up. This says I can, when you have a strictly positive PRC, it means I can never slow the neuron down. I can only advance the phase. So let's suppose that you're a stimulator and the neuron's going at 40 hertz. And you want to try and get it to go at 20 hertz, then no matter what you do, you won't be able to do that because you can't slow it down. However, if it's a Hodgkin-Huxley neuron going at 40 hertz, I mean, Hodgkin-Huxley squid axon going at 40 hertz, then you can slow it down because you can delay the onset of the next spike. Similarly, Pteroptix malucci, you can slow him down, and I say him because it's only the males that flash. It's, as far as I know, it's the only existing, only class of animals in existence where flashing actually attracts females. Well, except for some of you gals, I don't know. There may be people that flashing does attract. But in any event, I mean, you can go on the web and find all kinds of stuff like this. Anyway, the point is that these PRCs do, the way to interpret these PRCs is that they do tell you whether or not you can delay or advance the onset of a spike. So now, how can we couple things up with a PRC? Suppose we experimentally, you have a question?
With the PRCs that are strictly positive,
could you
delay that if you gave a negative?
Oh, yes, if you give a negative pulse, you can, because the PRC with a negative pulse looks just the opposite. Absolutely, yeah. So you could inhibitorily couple it, but I'm talking about positive pulses, yeah. All right, so given a PRC, can we create, let's couple two neurons if we have their PRC. Is there a way we can derive some sort of model for that? Because this is strictly ad hoc, because this is something you experimentally compute. So I want to get a model out of an experiment without knowing any of the, without actually writing down any equations. That's what's cool about PRC theory. Okay? So here's the idea. Let's suppose we have two oscillators. Okay? And they go around periodically with frequency omega 1. So what's the solution of this differential equation? Omega 1t. And when we hit 2 pi, we reset. Right? So it's like a really boring integrate and fire. Right? But we aren't really resetting because we're just going around the circle. Right? So this thing spins around. Now, how do we couple? Plus sum over n of delta t minus t2n capital delta of theta 1 of t. And we can put a parameter in here for the coupling. All right, now what is T sub 1? Oh, I'm supposed to do that. Jeez, I thought these screensavers, some of them really screw up your screen, and I thought maybe my computer was dying. All right. What is this? What is T sub 1n? Or T sub jn is the nth time theta sub j crosses 2 pi. All right, so every time it crosses 2 pi, it throws out a spike. You can make it 1. It doesn't matter whether it's 2 pi or 1 or anything. You can make any number you want, okay? But just as long as you keep it the same, all right? So what's that mean? It means, basically, that this guy's rolling along as usual at some phase, and then a perturbation comes, and it changes it. It either raises it or lowers it, all right? So now let's suppose that omega 1 equals omega 2. We can devise a map from this. We can write down a simple map. And what is that map? Whoa, gee. Oh, it's got little feet on it. All right, let's suppose with some loss in generality, WSLOG, that omega 1 equals omega 2, and the coupling's not too strong, all right, because I want to avoid all kinds of pathologies, then let phi be the time, the phase of theta 2 when theta 1 hits 1. We'll make the period 1 over omega, okay? So 1 is our base period, okay? Not 2 pi, because it's easier to write 1 than 2 pi. All right, so everybody's with me? Every time we hit 1, we reset. All right, then it turns out that you can write down the map is phi goes to 1 minus f of 1 minus f of phi, g of phi, where f of phi equals phi plus delta of phi. Okay? So that's the new phase after the perturbation comes. Because remember, your new phase is what you were before, plus whatever the PRC does. Okay? So some people have a name for this. This is called the phase transition curve, PTC. It's new phase versus old phase. Whereas delta is just the change in the phase. All right? So we get a map. Notice that now in most neurons, if you notice, if you remember all those pictures, they vanish at the origin and at one. Okay? So therefore, f of one equals f of zero equals zero. Okay? Oh, f of one equals one and f of zero equals zero. But 1 and 0 are the same thing, right? Because we're on a circle. Is this too confusing? Okay, 1 and 0 are the same thing. All right, so basically, 0 is a fixed point of this. 0 means synchrony. Right? Suppose, now there might be other fixed points, and you have to plot what g of phi looks like. And so, what one normally, if you take, for example, Reyes and Fetz, and you plot phi minus g of phi, the roots of that will tell you, or is it g of phi minus phi, or phi minus g of phi? I always hit the. Where the heck is it? I thought I had a nice picture of that. Well, in any event, one or the other, it doesn't matter, but you can draw those guys, okay? And zeros of that tell you what all the fixed points are, right? And if you draw these, they typically look like this. There's only two fixed points, synchrony and out of phase. And suppose that you have a fixed point phi bar. How do you know if it's stable? Well, you need g prime of phi bar to be less than 1 and greater than minus 1, right? Everybody buy that? Because that means the absolute value of g is less than 1. All right, and if we interpret that, how do we interpret that in these models? That means that 1 plus delta prime of 1 minus f of phi bar, I'm probably writing too small, so let me erase more. All right, what does this mean? It means, the thing shakes periodically, too. See, I can resonate. All right. One plus delta prime of 1 minus f of phi bar times 1 plus delta prime of phi bar has to be less than 1 and greater than 0. So that's the condition for stability of synchrony. Stability of any fixed point. Let's take in particular phi bar equals 0. That's the synchronous state. Then what do we get? I'm sorry, it should be minus 1. Oh, sorry. We get minus 1 is less than 1 plus delta prime of 1. I put a little minus here, which I'll change to 0. I'm sorry. Make this 0 plus 1 plus delta prime of, this should be 0 minus 1. 0 plus. All right, now this is math speak. What do I mean by 0 minus? I mean the limit as we approach 0 from below, because that's the same as approaching 1 from above, okay? Because 0 and 1 are the same. And this is approaching 0 from above, or maybe I have it backwards. It doesn't matter because it's symmetric in that. Okay, the point is we approach zero from one way and we approach zero from the other way. Why does that matter? Because, for example, if you look at the PRC from a cortical neuron, the slope is different at one end than the other. Right? So it's the product of those two. So now, since in both cases, okay, so we need the slopes to be between here. Minus one is not a problem. And the reason minus one is not a problem is I said that these perturbations were not too big. So this is always going to be non-negative, and this is always going to be non-negative. Okay? Because delta prime isn't too big. So that minus one is not a problem. However, one is a problem. One can be a problem because if delta prime of 0 plus is quite a bit big, is quite positive, and delta prime of 0 minus is not very negative, then the product of these guys could be bigger than 1. Because this is something bigger than 1, this is something smaller than 1, for example. Okay? However, if you look at Reyes, if you look at this picture up here, can you see that or not? The slope at the origin at this side is very small, and the slope at that side is quite big. So from that, you can see synchrony will always be asymptotically stable. Yes, sir?
You're doing a stability analysis now. I've lost track of what we're talking about being stable with respect to. I mean, it seems to me that the two modes, in retrospect, kind of obvious. You've got two degenerate sort of beginning uncoupled modes, and they combine to give you an even and an odd.
Right, that's right.
So that's independent of the coupling G.
Oh, I mean, the stability. If these guys aren't coupled, their phases can be anything.
I know that, but once you turn on G, you'll get even and odd modes, right?
I'm not sure I understand what you mean by...
Again. This is stable with respect to what kind of perturbation?
Stable to perturbations of... Let's view it as a limit... stable to any kind of perturbation, because I'm assuming the limit cycles are initially asymptotically stable. And because they're asymptotically stable, when I couple them, there's two zero eigenvalues corresponding to the phase, okay? Now we couple them, we turn the coupling on, one of those zero eigenvalues remains because it's still an autonomous system. I can shift the whole thing. The other zero eigenvalue is going to the other zero Floquet exponent, which corresponds to a Floquet multiplier of one, is either going to be inside the unit circle or outside the unit circle, okay? And this is that Floquet multiplier, okay? So that's the sense in which this is stable. This is assuming, in some sense, a weak coupling. Not infinitesimally weak, and I'll get to that shortly. This is assuming a kind of weak coupling. So it's stable with respect to arbitrary perturbations that don't take it too far from the limit cycle. Okay? You don't look convinced, but... What do you, arbitrary perturbations of the initial conditions of the limit cycle? Because we've reduced it all down to this simple phase idea. Because we're sitting on the limit cycle, and now we're looking along the. You see, you have this limit cycle, and everything is slamming down to it. When the coupling's not too strong, the most dangerous modes are the ones along the limit cycle. And so that's what we're analyzing here, those modes along the limit cycle. Okay? All right. So basically...
One question.
Yeah.
The gas over there, the function over there would be that...
I'm sorry, what?
This function over there, this would be the delta...
This one right here?
Yeah.
This is phi minus g of phi. So it's telling us all the fixed points of this. Or maybe it's g of phi minus phi. I always forget which one it is. Okay? Because g of phi will look like... Here's... g of phi will look something like this. Okay? And so the fixed points are right here. All right, and then you can see right away from using the usual kind of stuff that the way I've drawn it now, the zero is a stable fixed point, and this is an unstable fixed point.
Okay.
Okay.
These configurations of this, this mapping of...
Here?
Yeah. These would be the discretized version of the equations over there.
This comes about, yeah, that's reducing this equation up here to a map. Yeah. You can, I'll leave that as an exercise to derive this map. It's straightforward. You just, it's just a little bit of algebra. It's actually doing it with a nice picture. Yes, sir?
So where's the strength of coupling?
Huh?
You introduce strength of coupling G.
Yeah. Where's it in the map? Oh, I've absorbed G into delta, so... There you go. And I'm assuming that G is small, so that I'm going to assume that we're not in too much of a problem. Basically, PRC theory, the way I've outlined it, has to assume that f of phi is an invertible function, okay? Which means that f prime has to be positive, which means that delta prime can't be too negative, okay? And then everything's cool, right? Then all this stuff works very nicely. And what that essentially means is that the perturbation is not too strong. Okay? Now, I didn't want to dot all the I's, but there are caveats to all, there are caveats to all this stuff. There's caveats to almost anything in mathematics. That's the trouble with it. I mean, that's the beauty of it and the trouble of it. Okay. So, basically... For a PRC of two neurons using something like Reyes, synchrony is stable. Okay? And that's a really vague, I mean, that's a really strong statement, and it's making assumptions about the nature of the coupling and things like that. And I don't want to say much more about PRCs, except that you can, using the same ideas, you can put them into rings, you can put them into lines, and I have a PhD student that proved the existence of rotating waves in two-dimensional networks of coupled nearest neighbor coupled PRCs. So you can prove the existence of rotating waves in small networks of these things. You can also prove existence of rotating waves in rings with nearest neighbor coupling of PRCs. And you can also study stability of synchrony in all coupled PRCs. And that turns out to be really cool because in networks where you have different slopes at one end from the other end, then it turns out that the stability of synchrony in an all-to-all coupled system depends on how many guys you're coupling. So you can make up a PRC where if you have three guys coupled in all-to-all manner, then synchrony is stable, but if you couple four guys, then you get what's called heteroclinic cycles. And it's really neat. I mean, it's really fun mathematics, but it's totally irrelevant to neuroscience. But, you know, some of us are mathematicians and we like to play. I mean, that's sort of the bottom line. Okay. Now, I was going to talk about some other maps, but I think I'll skip that. Maybe I'll come back to that. There's other kinds of maps that you can develop. Here, the maps are assuming direct excitatory coupling. I'll just mention the setup, and then I'll refer you to some papers. Get you into the network mood. Suppose you have a system like this with excitatory and inhibitory neurons, okay? And the excitatory guy turns the inhibitory guy on. This guy turns this one. So you have two networks like this, okay? So you're driving, this guy is being driven with a stimulus. Stimulus S. This guy's being driven with a stimulus S. This guy turns the inhibitory neuron on, firing an action potential, which suppresses this guy for a while. Okay, so the period of this individual oscillator is governed primarily by the decay time of the inhibition. Okay, so this is an inhibition-based rhythm. This gives rise to a very nice rhythm. You can get nice 40 hertz oscillations fairly robustly by choosing certain parameters correctly. All right, Now, it turns out that this is sort of an abstraction of a rather complicated biophysical model used by Roger Traub to study coupling in two halves of a hippocampus. All right, these are excitatory neurons, inhibitory neurons, inhibitory neurons. And their model consisted of, I think, 3,200 cells, each with 16 or 64 compartments. And what they were trying to understand is synchrony between the two halves. And the only kind of coupling between the two halves they had was something like this. Okay? But there was a time delay in here. All right? So it turns out that you can reduce all this thing to a one-dimensional map. And you can quantitatively predict everything they did with their supercomputer. And because it's a one-dimensional map, you can understand it. I mean, understand it at the level of, okay, here's what this parameter will have to do, and here's what this parameter does. Okay? And it's really rather cute, and I'll refer you to a PNAS paper that Nancy Capel and I wrote, where we derived the maps for this. If we have time, I can come back to it later on. But it's somewhat technical, and so I don't want to spend too much time. But this, you can reduce the timing difference between the two excitatory neurons, again, to a map. The neat thing is that you can also explain some recent results on some genetically altered mice. There's certain genetically altered mice where what happens is the excitatory to inhibitory synapse has a longer time constant than normal. And that appears to completely disrupt the ability to synchronize these things. And what you find is if you analyze the behavior, if you construct the map under those conditions, you can see how the map changes to cause synchrony to be completely disrupted. Okay? So that's like hot off, that's not even been written up yet. But anyway, the experimental stuff was written, and the simulations, the Roger Traub simulations were done, but the analysis by maps has not been done yet. In any case, this is another application of maps that's more direct. The thing that makes these maps work is that these E cells, the excitatory cells, only fire when the amount of inhibition falls below a certain level. So they're almost like, they behave almost like integrating fire neurons, and then they fire right after that inhibition wears off. All right? So what's happening here is that this excitatory guy induces a spike in this inhibitory guy, okay, from this guy firing. And then there's a delayed spike introduced into the inhibitory guy from this guy. All right? And so you get a doublet. You get a pair of inhibitory spikes. And similarly here. And what the crucial part of the map, the nonlinear part of the map, appears in the fact that the timing of the second I spike depends on how soon after this E spike arrives from the last time the I spike fired, because these membranes have to recover. Okay, and you can explicitly write down this map. You can actually write down an analytic approximation for it that is valid for any model, because these things have a certain bifurcation structure. In any event, so you can write down this map, and that nonlinearity is what gives rise to the ability of these two things to synchronize. All right? Plus, you can get all kinds of complicated chaos if you want. All right, so I'll stop at the maps there, and now I want to introduce a more general formulation. What I want to now talk about is reduction methods. All right? And my main tool, I guess we have to stop soon, right? Because we have to leave here at 12:15. Well, my main tool is going to be the method of averaging. And I'm going to use averaging in several ways. In the first case, I'm going to derive a set of phase equations, weakly coupled oscillators. And in the second thing, I'm going to derive neural network models from biophysical models. All right. I don't know if you guys have seen that yet. Have you seen derivation of neural network models in biophysics? In other words, if you give me ionic and all that crap, and I'll derive a neural network model that has only one variable per neuron. Okay, so I'm going to talk about that as well. Both cases I'm going to be using heavily the theory of averaging. Let me just write down roughly what the averaging theorem says. Suppose I have a differential equation like this, and suppose that f of x, comma t plus capital T equals f of x t. I see determinants here, so I'm going to have to be real careful about how I state this. Anyway, so suppose I have a periodically forced system like this, and suppose that epsilon is small, and I want epsilon to be real small, so it's got to be a lot smaller than 1 over t as well, okay? So I don't want the period of the oscillation to be close to 1 over epsilon, all right? Then what the averaging theorem says is that in some sense the solutions to this can be well approximated by this differential equation. Okay, and what is f, or I should write f bar across here, f bar of y equals 1 over t, 0 to t, okay, so that's basically what the averaging theorem says. It says that we can approximate this periodically forced thing by something that's averaged. And that makes sense. Suppose you have something that's jiggling around like this. Well, then you can kind of smear out those jiggles. That's the whole point of the averaging theorem. Smear out the jiggles. All right? Yes? I'm sorry, what?
How is the y defined by the right?
Oh, okay. Let's look at the dynamics of this, and it says basically if x of 0 minus y of 0 is small, then for a certain amount of time, the solutions to these two equations will stay close to each other. Okay? That's the sense at which. So if you start with the same initial conditions for these two equations, then for a certain amount of time, they will stay very close to each other. Okay? And that amount of time is dependent on epsilon. And in fact, I think it's 1 over, is it 1 over epsilon, Dave?
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry, what? Is that all it was? Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Oh, well, that's easy. I can answer that one really easy. Okay, so the point is that this equation and this equation stay close to each other in some sense for an amount of time that's at least 1 over epsilon. Okay, but the crucial thing here, and this is where we hand wave later on, is that you don't want t to be too close to 1 over epsilon. All right, but I'm going to hand wave my way around that later on. All right, when I derive neural networks. So that's the averaging theorem, and I guess since I have to stop it, I don't want to start talking about weak coupling now, so I'll save all that for the afternoon. Is that okay? All right, so we'll stop here and pick up, what time do they pick up? 1:30 or 2? 2, is it 2? Okay, so whatever, 2, yeah, 1's too early. You have to give your intestines a chance. And I'm going to talk about intestines later on this afternoon. Okay, I hope that's not going to be too offensive. All right, I'll stop here.